actions in withholding all of this evidence were so egregious, and it appears that they knew exactly what they were doing.
Pete Kott's lawyer makes the case to have his convictions thrown out. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 17th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, checking in with some readers who won't ever read Sarah Palin's book and some who couldn't wait to.
I saw her on Oprah yesterday and I just wanted to read the book.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired with support from Lions Clubs.
Former Alaska lawmaker Pete Kott was in a federal courtroom in Anchorage again this morning. He listened as lawyers sparred over his future in front of Judge John Sedgwick. Kott's attorney is arguing all charges against him should be dropped, given new evidence the government was forced to turn over regarding the case. But federal prosecutors say the verdict against him should stand. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Pete Kott was convicted on bribery, conspiracy, and extortion charges in 2007, but he was released from prison in June after the work of the government lawyers who prosecuted his case came under question. It was the same legal team that won a conviction against former Senator Ted Stevens, a conviction that was later thrown out because they failed to turn over important evidence to the defense. Kott's lawyer, Cheryl Gordon McLeod, says her client is in the same boat.
The government lawyers today are different from the government lawyers who tried the case, and I think they appropriately acknowledged today that they should have turned over some of this evidence and that it was favorable to Pete Kott.
McLeod says with the new evidence, the government's case against Kott falls apart. She says it undermines his convictions on each of the three charges.
The charges against Pete Kott should be dismissed, thrown out, vacated, and he should not be retried because the government's actions in withholding all of this evidence were so egregious. And from the documents we've received, it appears that they knew exactly what they were doing.
During the trial, federal prosecutors attempted to prove Kott was accepting bribes from oil services company Vico to push legislation favorable to the oil industry. They used their star witness, former Vico president Bill Allen, to establish the quid pro quo necessary to win the convictions. But McLeod says Allen lied in court.
What Bill Allen said on the stand totally contradicted what the statements that were attributed to him in the documents that I've seen.
The government is arguing the new evidence makes no material difference in Pete Kott's guilt or innocence. They said it only took the jury one day to convict him after seeing and hearing dozens of recordings of him accepting money from Vico. They also heard him under the famous line that he, quote, had to cheat, steal, beg, borrow, and lie, end quote, in order to help Vico. Judge Sedgwick said he would issue a ruling in the case as soon as possible. He has several options, including dismissing the convictions against Kott or ordering a new hearing on the evidence. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Former Governor Sarah Palin's book, Going Rogue, hit the stands in bookstores across the country today. It's already a bestseller from pre-sales. In the nation's capital, interest in the book is high. However, at a Midtown Washington, D.C. Barnes & Noble this morning, only one customer bought the book at the front counter during a half hour around 9 a.m. Craig Roberts works as chief of staff for Republican Congressman John Shimkus of Illinois.
I'm going to be a little bit late for work, so I could get two copies of the Sarah Palin book this morning. We wanted to get it as quickly as possible. Actually have about five people in the office who want them, but each of them are getting them at different stores on their way in.
A statement from bookseller Barnes & Noble says Going Rogue is the number one title on its online store, and the company expects in-store sales to be strong this week. At an Anchorage branch this morning, a few customers were checking out with the book. Lucy Brown says she's a big reader and couldn't wait to get a copy.
I saw her on Oprah yesterday and I just wanted to read the book. Just, I'm nosy. I just wanted to know what was in it.
But standing right in front of Brown in line, Tina DeLapp declared she would never purchase a copy of Going Rogue. She calls Sarah Palin an embarrassment.
I basically think she's out for money and I don't want to contribute to her income. I just wish she'd go away.
A few blocks away, Tidal Wave Books hadn't sold any copies of the book yet, but they did have one customer looking for Going Rouge, Sarah Palin, and American Nightmare instead. The book is a collection of essays critical of Palin. It's only available online. Anchorage resident Dario Nadi was hoping to snag a copy in person.
Yeah, I come down looking for the other book that's coming out today. So I'm on my way somewhere else to see if I can find it. I kind of wanted to see the counter opinion.
Local blogger Shannon Moore is one of two Alaskans who contributed essays in the book. She says Going Rouge was a chance to gather a range of thoughtful criticism of Palin.
I think what it was basically to sort of put in one place a group of people who had been, you know, critical of different aspects of her, but to basically answer whatever was going to come out in her book.
Some people who consider themselves conservatives say liberals are scared to death of Palin and her prospects for the 2012 presidential race. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that my criticism of liberals is that they think she's a joke, that they don't take her seriously. And certainly, you know, Sarah Palin has made a sort of a cartoon of herself, a parody almost. But, you know, she is able to motivate a small percentage of Americans. And what she's able to motivate them to do, I think, is very serious, to basically take away the Americanism of the president or of people who are not of the same ideology that they are. They're suddenly less American or less patriotic or love their country less. And I think that fundamentally is what's really dangerous about her.
And Shannon, it seems like your career has benefited from Palin's stardom. Do you think there's some irony there?
Well, it is very ironic. And, you know, there's a lot to be thankful for. I would have never, I met a long lost cousin who found me after appearing on Rachel Maddow's show. I've met Rachel. I've been able to meet Keith Olbermann, Howard Dean, lots of people that I wouldn't have and made connections. And I think really I'm looking forward to a time where, you know, even more issues about Alaska we can talk about on a national stage, not just Sarah Palin, certainly, but I want to be able to talk about other things that are important to Alaska other than Sarah Palin. And hopefully, you know, the sort of stage that she set for me will still be applicable.
I know it just was released today, but have you read parts or all of Going Rogue?
I'm about two-thirds through, I think. I really feel after reading it that, A, it should be in, like, revisionist history sections of bookstores. It's just very strange that she wrote things down that are so easily refutable. And then the other thing is that I'm really getting a sense that she is trying to set a stage to run again. And I didn't have that before. But her underlying message here is that the reason that John McCain lost is because she wasn't allowed to be her. And if she was just allowed to be herself, she would have, you know, gone much further.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a homeless man in Sitka highlights the unique hardships of living on the street in a small town.
I've lived under bridges. I'm not blaming society on this, no way. I made some terrible mistakes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A coalition of community leaders held a summit in Sitka recently to decide how they can address the issue of homelessness. Service providers reviewed what they offer. The police and fire chiefs addressed public safety issues. Sitka is just one of many Alaska communities without a centralized support system for the homeless. In the first of a three-part series, KCAW's Ed Ronco profiles one man for whom finding a safe place to sleep is a daily struggle.
On penny detail today, huh?
Yeah. Charles Wheaton likes to start every day at 6 a.m. with a cup of coffee from the grocery store.
Just $1, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Wheaton is 53 years old. He's a little over 6 feet tall, clean-shaven, with jet black hair underneath a red baseball cap. He wears a backpack over four layers, a hooded sweatshirt, and three light jackets. It's 37 degrees outside as Wheaton starts walking up Baranoff Street.
I became homeless about 4 years ago, and I've lived under bridges. I'm not blaming society on this, no way. I made some terrible mistakes.
He spent some time at Lemon Creek Correctional Center, including 2 years for assault in 1988. He says he's not proud of that, but is also frustrated that the conviction on his record prevents him from obtaining housing in certain places. Recently, he was living in Haines with his fiancée, Judy, but she died about 6 months ago, and he found himself out on the street again. On this particular morning, he has just spent the night aboard a dry-docked boat. It's hard to know how many people are homeless in Sitka. What is known is that they are men and women, old and young. Some camp in the woods, others get hotel vouchers from local service providers, or sleep on boats. And a few, between 5 and 15 regulars, according to police, are often picked up on the streets for having an open alcohol container or for public intoxication. Wheaton says he drinks, but not to the point of incapacitation.
What I do it for, I drink to forget the problems of the day, because I have no place to go. And I've been cited for open containers, and they said, you're not supposed to be drinking outside. I said, well, I'm homeless, where am I supposed to drink?
The walk continues, and Wheaton leads me to a small brown house tucked away in a neighborhood behind Swan Lake.
This is Jericho Road.
Jericho Road is a small shelter for people with addictions and no other place to go. Wheaton can't live here because of the conviction on his record, but he visits his friends who do.
They know we're coming.
He taps on the window to announce his presence.
Kind of like my signal light in here. Dino!
Hey!
Dino is Dean Sharklane, also 53 years old, and one of two people currently living at the house. When we walk in, the local news is on and some coffee is brewing. For Sharklane, Jericho Road has provided a refuge from not only the elements, but from other pitfalls.
You meet all these people. There's lots of people out in the street that are doing drugs. I've been there, and fortunately, it's been about 3 years now since I quit drugs. And I'm still stuck with alcoholism, and alcoholism is a kind of a fuel for homeless people, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say that.
And almost everybody that is homeless that I know it does lead to alcoholism. And then you all kind of congregate together, and then sometimes you don't know who you're going to meet. You don't know who's going to be your friends. So you got to be really careful on who you meet out in the street.
Even though he can't stay here, Wheaton says more places like Jericho Road are needed. And he says that in most of the communities where he's lived, there seem to be better shelters for animals than for people.
Dogs and cats are treated better in every community than the homeless people. I've seen a multi-million dollar medical thing right across from Fred Meyer's in Juneau where it's for an animal hospital. I mean, this is far better than the glory hole downtown, and if we in each community could focus on doing something like that with government spending and get some of these people that are homeless like me off the street, I'd feel better about myself and want a chance to change.
Wheaton has some income. He gets government disability checks because of his bipolar disorder, and he's found ways to support himself in the past, including some work with the Salvation Army. He used to manage one of its stores, and last Christmas, he rang the bell at one of its donation kettles.
At Wally's World in Juneau, and they made quite a bit of money, and I still got that bell that I rang last year. And I told the captain, I'm going to bring it back to Juneau. I'm going to ring this bell again. And I'm looking forward to it.
In the time since our interview, Wheaton has returned to Juneau. When we last talked to him, he had just bought a tent for $10 and was searching for a safe place to set up camp.
You know, I guess you can call the whole world my home. You know, the sky is my ceiling and the ground is my floor, so... Mm-hmm. I'll just keep walking the road and until I find a place to live.
This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
More individuals are utilizing the Salvation Army's soup kitchen and food pantry in Ketchikan. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, soup kitchen attendance has nearly doubled in the past several months, and food pantry usage this year has already topped last year's total.
I brought some tuna fish.
Estrid Crocker is buttering banana bread and slapping together sandwiches while Peggy Hovick stirs what she's calling youth group soup, a chicken stew made by the First Lutheran Church confirmation class. Hovick estimates she and Crocker have been cooking and serving food to the community's homeless, unemployed, and low-income residents for about 9 years now.
I feel like it has to be done, and I'm just one of the many people that are seeing a need and responding to it. It's very sad to see that our town has this much need.
This fall, Hovick noticed a spike in the number of residents she was feeding, to the point where she and other volunteers have doubled the amount of food they prepare.
It was a shock to see. It was fairly manageable last year with 20 to 25 people. But now this is, you know, well, double the people, double the food, double the volunteers that we need.
And it's not just the amount of people who are utilizing the service that's changed. Crocker says the demographics are also shifting.
It used to be like all men, and maybe one woman once in a while, but now I get women in here too, and kids. So that's one change I've seen.
As Crocker and Hovick continue to prepare lunch, men, women, and a handful of children begin to funnel into the Salvation Army's dining room as they wait for the clock to strike 12:30. At that point, as is the case each weekday, the kitchen will serve lunch for a half hour. Sitting at one of the rows of folding tables in the dining room are Ginger and Kenny Harmon. She says the two have had to rely on the soup kitchen as they've struggled to keep up with their household bills.
Mainly to feed our kids and the one on the way, just because we're hungry. Or we don't have enough money for food because it's all going to bills, mainly KPU.
The couple moved to Ketchikan last year from Washington State. Like many other recent transplants from the lower 48, Harmon says she was shocked by the cost of food.
And the fact that we get less food stamps here was even more of a shock.
While the Salvation Army can't say for sure what is driving the jump in those using the food pantry and soup kitchen, Major James Halverson says the increase was both sudden and dramatic.
First part of this year in 2009 was kind of flat. You know, in other words, just 35 or so. And then all of a sudden it started jumping up to 60 people, you know, a day.
Ketchikan appears to be mirroring a troubling national trend. The U.S. Department of Agriculture this month released a report showing approximately 15% of Americans last year lived in households where there was not a consistent and adequate supply of food. That's up from 11% of the population the year prior. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Alaska Wounded Veterans Project, a nonprofit organization that provides assistance to veterans who were wounded both physically and psychologically during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Information at alaskastateelks.org. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. Programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The outgoing federal gas pipeline coordinator says she's not sure what the Obama administration has in mind for her position or the office she started. But Drew Pierce says the White House maintains that getting a pipeline to transport Alaska's North Slope gas is a priority. The Obama administration forced Pierce out of her job running the office of the federal coordinator in Washington. She announced her resignation yesterday, effective early January. Pierce says she's not sure what's next for the office charged with coordinating an Alaska gas pipeline project.
I don't have a sense of what the new direction is that the Obama administration is planning to pursue, but they did tell me that they had a new vision for the Office of the Federal Coordinator, and for that they wanted new leadership.
The White House has not yet said who it's looking at to replace Pierce. It sought input from Alaska senators, but not from Governor Sean Parnell or Congressman Don Young. Pierce says the Obama administration has the power to put whomever it wants in the job.
Clearly, they won the election, and so they have decided to make a political change, and I would expect whomever comes into the position to be a Democrat. I certainly hope they bring an Alaskan in, because this job needs to be in Alaskans.
The office was created by Congress to coordinate the pipeline work of 22 federal agencies, the state, lower 48, and Canadian efforts. President George W. Bush appointed Pierce to open the office in 2006. Since Bush left office last year, questions have swirled around whether Pierce would leave her job with the usual changeover of political appointees. Five native groups, a science center, and a seafood cooperative are joining together to promote oyster farming in southeast Alaska. Representatives of the seven organizations and businesses met last week to form the Southeast Shellfish Coalition. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
Shellfish farmers have been growing oysters in southeast waters for more than two decades. But members of the new coalition say there's growing interest in expanding the industry, especially from native corporations and tribal entities. They say they can speed the industry's growth by coordinating startup efforts, providing support services, and marketing jointly. Michelle Metz of the Tlingit-Haida Central Council says mariculture can provide jobs that allow villagers to stay in their home communities.
We believe that oyster farming and other shellfish farming allows people the opportunity to have a cash income that works with a subsistence economy, because it's not 8 to 4, 35 days a week kind of job, so you can work the two lifestyles together.
The coalition includes Sea Alaska, the regional native corporation for Southeast, as well as the village native corporations for Yakutat and Craig. Other members are Cakes Tribal Government, Prince of Wales Islands Alaska Oyster Cooperative, and the Ketchikan-based Oceans Alaska Marine Science Center. Sea Alaska's Anthony Lindoff says the corporation is working with Tlingit-Haida Central Council to prepare shellfish farmers.
One of the main components of the coalition is to tackle the education and training component of it. So we're open to new ideas, and we're excited about the opportunities here to provide training and long-term sustainable jobs for the community.
The Oyster Coalition is working with the Alaska Shellfish Growers Association, a longtime statewide industry group. Members say they may also expand into geoduck and other clam farming efforts. They hope to tap into federal, tribal, and agricultural grant programs to help establish new farms, which cost about $200,000 each. Casey Havens is general manager of Yaktatquan, the village corporation for Yakutat.
These people are farmers, and they're planting seed and they're growing. So therefore, after the first of the year, we'll see beginners farming grants and those type of things that we'll be taking advantage of and teaching the prospective farmers to take advantage of.
Coalition members met with the Sea Alaska Board of Directors and Governor Parnell's office during their recent meetings. They say one of their efforts will be to address regulatory issues that could slow development. John Sund of Oceans Alaska says the new organization could make significant contributions to the industry's growth.
This group is one of the great breakthroughs. I think this is a real game changer in terms of moving public policy and bringing attention to the concept and the opportunity that we have.
The coalition hopes to win state funding for a shellfish hatchery and other infrastructure. Sun says that could cost several million dollars over 5 to 6 years. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The 2010 pollock quota is likely to decrease again this year by at least 2,000 metric tons, down to 813,000. Scientists presented data to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's groundfish plan team today that suggests the allowable biological catch is slightly less than last year's. Last year, scientists predicted that the quota might go back up. Alaska Fisheries Science Center Director Doug DeMaster says the population of 2006-year class fish was smaller than they expected.
The numbers were supposed to see female spawning biomass, they thought, would go up to something on the order of 1.8 million tons, and the estimate is more like 1.3 million tons. In part, I think that's related to the year class that we had been following. The 2006 year class just didn't show up as strongly as we had anticipated with the models prior to getting this year's data.
But DeMaster says the pollock stock does show signs of improvement.
The projection into 2011 is still positive, and it looks like we've got a couple good years of above-average recruitment in 2006 and 2008. So the stock appears to be showing positive signs of recruitment. That suggests that we should be back up to kind of our target level by 2012 in terms of pollock.
The recommended allowable biological catch is based on data collected by fisheries observers and the 2009 summer bottom trawl and acoustic midwater surveys. The actual quota will not be set until December's North Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting. Greenpeace is advocating for a more significant reduction in the quota. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Grant Station, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.